Okay, here we go again. A third podcast in 4 days, I guess. And
incredible.
And we are back with my dear friend Hagen. I miss you, buddy.
I thought he left me. He has left me, actually. But yeah, you're back from Spain.
I'm back from Spain.
How cool is that? And yeah, this is Christian, I thought we might start with keeping you a little bit updated what is going on in the Insert Buzzword podcast. Which is actually, not only we don't have bad equipment, we have new equipment.
Yeah, that's true.
And the last time with Albert, we kind of not got it together really properly. So I sounded a little bit weird and I had no gates on and therefore you heard me breathing all the time. That was a little bit unfortunate.
But we are improving, continuously improving.
Yes. And today I'm sitting in the edge of Berlin to Brandenburg.
Yeah, close in the woods. Moscow.
Close to Moscow. It's freezing cold here. And Christian, where are you?
I'm in the Lower Saxony, in the middle of nowhere. I think it's fair to say it's like flyover country of Germany. Rural Germany. Little 400 inhabitants village at my mother's place.
Wow. And even the German internet seems to be able to connect us.
It's, yeah, incredible. And we have this new, I mean, we had this new Ultraschall setup now for 4 podcasts or 5-ish. But now we are using Studio Link to connect us. And yeah, that seems to work out pretty well, I guess. It's fair to say.
Yeah, let's wait until we hear ourselves and
in the
final master.
True.
Yeah, and lately we have seen a lot of interview partners in our podcast.
Yeah, I got my recording gear with me when I was at the HPC Advisory Council workshop in Spain, in Santiago de Compostela, where the Jakobsweg. What is the English term for Jakobsweg?
I guess it's Jakobsweg.
Maybe.
Sounds fine to me.
Sounds fine to you. Yeah, I was there for a day and gave a state of the Linux containers talk. And I had who was first was Professor DK Panda from the Ohio State University. And we talked about HPC in general and the communication and interconnects in particular. And then I talked with Dan Olds about the student cluster competition of the HPC communities all around the world. That was fun. And yeah, so you were
actually
out for 2 days, for 2 episodes. But when recording it or after and listen to it again, I really missed you in there because you would have brought in a new perspective and an outsider perspective. I think that would be very worthwhile having you around. So we have to keep you or get you in there somehow so that you can ask stupid questions. Stupid questions from outside the HPC community. I think that would be very very cool for non-HPC listeners if someone is around and asks the questions that everyone is asking himself to listen to it. So
yeah, I see that. But the first person was, I met him also in February, right?
True.
So he is the guy who implemented some native support underneath the Hadoop framework for HDFS and HBase, so you have some native network interface drivers or something.
Yeah, exactly. So normally in non-HPC you use TCP, right? You have to go through the kernel and all this jazz. And in HPC you don't use the kernel for communication, you directly communicate to the network interface. It's called kernel bypassing. And there are a lot of libraries for this, or actually there's, I think, 2 that are really used. And he took, I think it is Java Netty, the network library, and implemented it in this native HPC libraries. So he can swap in this HPC stuff without touching the upper layer, basically, because he can just use an InfiniBand boosted version of Netty, and then he tweaks around with it. And he does this for like 20 years or so. So he has a lot of experience with it. And it's very, very cool what he does. Because then you can use InfiniBand gear or RDMA gear in more general terms. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Interesting. He was a little bit, his slides are very complex and it's hard to follow him. He throws in a lot of slides in a 30 minutes talk, and sometimes it's just a little bit too much to get everything.
Yeah,
but I think it's actually worth investigating when somebody wants to have some, or has InfiniBand in his data center.
No, yeah, but
which I think don't not so many people actually have that.
Yeah, no, true. But here's the thing, that there is RDMA, which is a generic term for remote DMA, so direct memory access, so that some other host can mess with your memory, and this is the basic concept behind all this HPC communication, right? That you do not have to be aware that someone wants to communicate with you. And there is a Ethernet version of it. It's called RDMA over converged Ethernet, which is dubbed Rocky. And all this stuff that he is doing works the same way with Rocky. So if you have 10 gig E or 40 gig E, okay, I assume it's not that common yet, but it's coming. It's getting cheaper and cheaper. Then you can use this stuff as well. You don't need InfiniBand in general. You just need RDMA, which is also possible over Ethernet. And then we are talking, I think, because then you can use this just off the shelf.
Hmm.
And he's doing it for Kafka. And I think we talked about it in February with him as well. So if you happen to have 10 gig E and Kafka, then maybe there is something you want to do.
Kafka can't hardly be faster than it is already. No, but surely there's always... But I think it's... that's it. Yeah, let's see what he comes up when he does Kafka. But we are switching now. Do we do the news section? Are we good with housekeeping now?
Yeah,
I think what somehow... Let me... So I think in the future we do more of these interviews, and we... if one of our two listeners, which is not Christian or I, is interested in being interviewed, he should definitely shoot us an email, because I think also for the next topics in the news that I have, we have two people waiting in the line for being interviewed with us. I think one is Christopher, right?
Yeah.
And Lars is out on holidays today in south of Italy, but he will be back, and then we will talk with him about Flink. And stateful query implementation for stream processors.
Yeah, and I think also we should get him in when we talk about the topic we have on our agenda today. I think today we would just briefly go over it and then make a more extensive podcast about the particular technology, right? What do you think?
Yeah, I think we should definitely... I just want to get the news out there, basically, and catch up with you, make the test for a remote podcast, and then... The next episode would be either Ceph or Flink or something, I think.
Yeah, and I met one guy at the HPC Advisory Council workshop. He works for a EU-funded project. It's called Horizon 2020. That's an envelope project to boost the compute capability in Europe in general. And there's one sub-project called, what was it called? EuroExa? I think it was EuroExa. So the Exascale project of the European Union. And he is the chair of this, or the leader, whatever, the guy who's having the hands on it. And that would be cool to talk to him here as well. So it's like having little ARM chips and FPGAs and 20 megawatts of power consumption and really crazy stuff. So... I already warned him that I will send him an email, and then he has to talk to us.
Would be interesting, actually. I'm so I tried to research a little bit because the last time I dropped out very fast and basically stating that all the code of Linux is a waste of time. maybe I should give that a little bit more background. I'm not saying that Linux is obsolete, but I'm just asking myself, where's the innovation if we stop asking ourselves what's the best architecture? And FPGAs seem to be more common now, and it's more accessible even to normal developers and not very special purpose machine close developers. And so I was digging in how I could basically get my Lisp machine going on an FPGA. And yeah, I'm interested.
you're hooked.
Yeah. No, I think what is a container? A container just shares the kernel namespace, right? And
spaces.
Or the kernel. And so that's already good because we're not repeating ourselves in terms of using millions of lines of code from a operating system. But what about not at all using one? Maybe just using the devices. Like,
yeah, but I mean, you mix two things, right? The operating system, file system or user land, and the kernel. The kernel is the same about in every Linux. I mean, in quotes, it's a little bit slightly different, but the code base is the same.
Yeah, yeah, but we are still using a kernel code base. Is it already the bare minimum that you need for accessing the CPU and the network and your storage devices?
No.
Can you not like get even less, like less lines of code?
Yeah. That's another podcast we should do. It's unikernels.
Yeah.
We want to talk about unikernels.
Yeah. So I was just thinking about that when I was saying that we maybe should not be stuck on an x86 and a Linux kernel for in the next 100 years. That's
no,
all
no.
I wanted to say.
Yeah.
But anyhow.
Anyhow.
News. Now back to the news.
Yeah, back to the news. We are in the housekeeping still and it's 12 minutes in.
But let's do the news then.
Yeah. I have one. No, the
okay.
First news, the most important news to me currently, because I, as I'm my mother's place, we got fiber here. Yay! Like, 200 megabits a second down and 20 up. Here you go. That's going to be awesome. And you can choose between 100 and 200 megabits. And I told my mother, yeah, you fill in your bank details and you sign the paper and your son will check the boxes, what to use.
Should it not be the other way around?
No. No. The process is important here.
I see.
And
congratulations.
I was very mean. I said to her, you don't want 200 megabits? Don't you love your son? And then, bam, was gone.
I see.
Do you want him to stay in Berlin?
Then I, forever?
Forever. Yeah, but that's besides the point. Anyway, let's get to the news. I make a chapter here.
Okay.
Okay, updates from the Kafka world. What's the latest?
Yeah. So the latest news is probably Kafka SQL, which is a implementation on top of Kafka's stateful standing query capabilities that they, which is, I think, still news. And which allows you basically to write SQL against Kafka topics. And there are some assumptions. So for instance, you need to have a flat topic, right? If you put in a whole bunch of nested structures into one topic or Avro schemas, that won't work. But if you have a flat structure, you can think now if you transform your messy data into small, flat table structures, like you would in an SQL table, just some columns. Basically, you can now have these represented as Kafka topics as a change, as a stream of changes, and then query those. And you can join, and you have three types of joins, I guess, left, outer, and inner join. And there's a little, it's still alpha, and you need some backend power to compute all this, but it's out there. Basically, you can now have Kafka and get your data in and make a nice job in separating what you would like to see. And then you just spawn up a SQL console and issue queries against your stream processor or your big Kafka cluster. And that's really amazing. We tested it the other week and it worked out of the box. I think you want to load test it and take some other considerations for any kind of real big data-ish stuff, but I think it's amazing. It's something like Pig and Hive for Hadoop took, they are also out there, but they are slow, and then there are a lot of optimizing now. It's such a clean, simple solution. I'm such a big fan of KSQL because it's makes your life easy, right? You just throw in a whole bunch of data, then you write your small little transformation stream processors, and you output whatever you feel like should be your domain knowledge, or you should be representing the models of your domain. And once separated out, you have a fully working, distributed, high available, shared SQL database.
Yeah,
which is amazing.
To put a little example in, so imagine you have a user base and you have like access logs, something like that. So you could have a Kafka JSON blob that you push to a Kafka topic where you say, okay, user X logged in, and this will then be kept in the state of the SQL query. And you push another item or items, what this user is doing, into another Kafka topic. And then you can join this too and create a topic that joins the user information with identified by the user ID with the user ID that's in this query or access topic. And then you can work with this, right?
Yeah. So you can basically join actually by any field. But you have these and it's now a little bit, but it has to be like that. This SQL is standard, some 98 or 89 standard SQL engine, but in between the lines you now can specify how long should your observable windows be or are, whatever English. So you like over the last 10 minutes join this, and then you get a joined, or the result will be all the information's taken within that time window, which might be limiting in certain situations, but it's just that from last year when we started this podcast, they started the streaming, then they added a little bit of stateful stream processing and replayable data, and everything was event driven basically from there on, and could be completely replayed, and you could restore your state at any given time. And then they added now the states of the stream processors could then be exposed in terms of, like, you just have a web framework and you have your stream processor and you put them together. And then you had queryable streaming state. And now on top of that, they built the SQL engine, and everything happened basically in 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's
pretty amazing.
Maybe we shouldn't talk too much about it because we should obviously make a single podcast out of it. But it builds all on top of Kafka Streams, right? It's with this building block, you can do this kind of cool magic and provide a simple API or simple query language for everyone to use.
And I guess that's something, we should sketch this out a little bit more, and then hopefully Lars chimes in and gives us some more details how Flink solved these problems, because I know Flink has something very similar to this, but I'm not sure how this internally works. And
So
as
this
is a teaser for the next big podcast. This is something I'm really interested in.
Yeah, and it's even usable for me who is not able to write Java, right? Because you just use SQL.
Somebody needs you to... I guess you can throw your data in there with Golang.
Cool.
And if you do a proper job in throwing them in the right structure, then you don't even need any transformation, and you're good.
And that's a limitation for me. Proper job with data structures. No, just kidding. Okay, next topic. Update from the Elasticsearch world.
Oh yeah. For God's sake, I didn't do any bullet points at that. They threw out a nice blog post last week or the week before, where they shared basically all their, not all, but a lot of consultancy experience. If you have a big Elasticsearch installation, you can hire Elastic.co to help you out with service. And one of the challenges when you do an Elasticsearch cluster is kind of how much capacity requirements do I have now, and what is my path for scaling it up or down? And because Lucene is somewhat very general purpose data structures, so it's a search index, of course, but it's also a columnar storage system, and on top of Elasticsearch there are a lot of goodies which makes them distributed and elastic, as it states in the name, and therefore it makes it also very hard to get a proper setup and get the most out of your hardware and get the scaling right with also with, if you have some money limitations, you want to put as most data on one node, for instance, or you want to save hardware capacities. And what they did is basically they wrote a nice little blog post. We should put that in the show notes, where they say how many shards you can have, what's the average shard size they see in production system, what is a reasonable amount of data nodes, how many masters you should have, what you need to take care of to keep your cluster state in a somewhat manageable size, and what this affects the time storage. Most of the time, Elasticsearch is used on rotating data. Basically, you keep all your logs for one day, and then you roll over to the next day and keep the logs on the next day, but this adds a lot more shards to your cluster, and it's not always very clear without proper load testing how much shards you can actually manage on one particular data node. And they made a nice description also about the trade-offs. Sometimes you trade retention time, so how much indices can you open for reads, and then you trade that against write performance, for instance. And yeah, they did a pretty good job. Also, with Elasticsearch, I think 5.5 or 6 alpha, they have two new APIs. One is the Shrink API that helps you basically to re-index indices that you had created with lots of shards for making them fast for writes and reads, but then when you retire your data, or you they are not at the most common interest now because they are maybe 2 months old, then you re-index them into an index with a lot less shards, and you can now have an API where you configure this, and then it will do it basically automatically. You say, all my data that is older than 30 days, please shrink them into index with say 2 shards instead of 20. Yep. That makes them slower for query, but maybe you don't need so much so responsive queries anymore for that old data, but you want to have other resources to handle more shards on the most recent data, and therefore you save some cluster management capacity basically by reducing the number of shards. And the other API is the I think it's the rolling API, but I should create better notes. Basically, you now configure on the indices themselves how they should roll. So you would basically create an alias where you say, these are my logs. And then you say, okay, logs from 1 week have the resolution per day. And then after 1 week, I create a new index pattern that rolls over per week. So then you index a whole week of singular indices per day into one big index that holds all the data for 1 week. This also gives you leverage the cluster a little bit better, so that you have less indices to manage and less shards to cope with if you are in failover scenarios.
So it's an extension of the shrink one, right?
Yeah, it just makes
while
it,
roll
it, they two work. Yeah, they two work together basically.
Yeah, yeah, while rolling over, you reduce the amount of indices, and you can define how many shards you want to have.
Yeah, oh. And that helps you managing better the resources of your cluster. And formerly you would have, like, this was all basically up to you. So you were writing a program that were doing the indexing, and at midnight your program would check, it's midnight, I have to create a new index, and then route all the indexing documents to the new index. And this logic now can be removed out of your client code, and it's basically handled by Elasticsearch. Okay. And you just—it's now becoming a configuration skill for the Elasticsearch administrator and consultant. And yeah, I think it's a really good idea, because that always leads to confusion how to deal with this. I mean, still you would need to have a good knowledge about your data and your capacities and the expectations for retention, but it's nice that they added all these APIs, and for these two new APIs, you don't have to pay. So this is also okay.
Yeah, maybe they get so many customer requests that they cannot handle it anymore. So they hand out some of the consultancy work they do internally to the whole world.
They did it.
Conspiracy theory.
They were always quite open about stuff, but I guess what they also learned is that it's so special. It's just that you want these, what's über den Daumen gepeilte Größen?
Rule of thumb.
Rule of thumb. Ah, yeah, they came up with, they did this all the time, but sometimes it leads to people interpreting it as a very fixed constraint and then being very stubborn about it. And it's always, you always trade basically, and it's always a little bit tweaking and alchemy to get the most out of your hardware. I think it's just very nice that they put their experience out on the blog and that they added these two new APIs. So there should be less pain in the future managing Elasticsearch clusters, because there have been situations where where it was kind of tricky, and some say that you could even end up with a data loss in particular failure scenarios. Are we actually saying failure scenarios or disaster recoveries? What's the what's the difference actually?
Disaster recovery is if
everything happened already. So it's shit already. So what we're doing now.
You know, I don't know what the textbook's thing is, but disaster recovery is if you have an active data center where your stuff is running and you have a backup data center where your stuff is backup to, then disaster recovery is a meteor like blew your active data center and you have to like restore the stuff, and it's an extreme event. And failure is something that you could handle earlier and often, more often, and it's not totally doomsday scenario. It's just something that happened that you expect.
I see. Yeah. So I saw both with Elasticsearch.
Okay.
But anyhow.
Yeah.
That should make our lives better.
Yeah.
I see somebody wants to talk about RCUDA. What's that?
Ah, here we go. Yeah. I want to make a mark first. Somehow. Yeah. Yeah, I said I was at the HPC Advisory Council workshop in Spain, and a guy that I have on the radar for a couple of, I think, years now, like 2 years or so, is Fede from the University of Valencia, and he created a remote CUDA client-server architecture where you can run CUDA programs that are not bound to the local GPUs, but can connect to a server which are supplying GPUs for them, and they use
what?
Yeah, they is pretty cool, and they gave a little presentation and also a demonstration where they showed it off. I mean, I think it's a simple concept as to that it's just intercepting the codes as the calls that you do to the GPU and then sends them over to a remote server that then relays the calls to a remote GPU. So you just have to preload a different library than the original CUDA library, and then it will transparently relay the calls to remote GPUs. And if you have a fast Ethernet or a fast InfiniBand, so you need some fast interconnect to make it really cool, But for some workloads, you don't even need this because you copy just a bunch of data over, then it's processed, and then you copy it back. So if you don't need a lot of inter-process communication, then it's even fine with low-end Ethernet. So they showed it with 1 gig E, so pretty simple. And yeah, that's pretty cool. And it's simple, and it screams containers so all over the place.
How does it work? So I would basically have my editor and I create a program that will come up with a finalized CUDA bundle already, or do I just have basically the source code and send the source code over and the final CUDA hardware will then compile that and run it on their infrastructure?
It's pretty simple. So you download a tar, then you extract it, and on your host with the GPUs, you start a little server. It's RCUDA-D. You have to have some environment variables, so what interconnect to use, so InfiniBand or TCP, and you provide this with some configuration stuff. And then you start the server. It will connect to all the GPUs on your system. And on the client side, you download the tar, you extract it, and you point your LD library path, so the path which is used to determine Link. Which libraries to use, which shared libraries to use. You change this so that the RCUDA libraries are seen before the CUDA libraries, and then it's transparent to you. I think you need to recompile and you need to use a certain flag so that it will use the RCUDA libraries instead of the CUDA libraries, but that's basically it then. And then you fire it up and off you go.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. So, yeah.
And since it's also, again, if you use InfiniBand, or even if you use just the GPU, it's not much kernel involved. I think it's even fair to say that's no kernel involved at all. You need the driver and the kernel, but so you can put it in containers and then you can run all this CUDA stuff in different containers and using remote GPUs, having a big box with 8 GPUs and 20 boxes without GPUs, and they can all use the GPUs of the remote host. So that's pretty cool. And You can use it with a Linux client, you can have ARM clients, x86, Power, you can use it on Windows. They have a new version where they have Windows support, so you can have a Windows client using RCUDA. It's pretty neat.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You have this, going back to the very old days where you were sharing in a university the one big machine that the university bought for endless amount of money, you could now basically also type your program somewhere else, and then if you need the big computation, you can then get your time sliced share of the whatever really expensive NVIDIA cluster you bought, and then run there.
Yeah, exactly. That's cool. You can use this DGX boxes that we saw in Stanford for 130,000, so pretty cheap.
Yeah,
cool. Which is the cool thing, is he had a node with one GPU, and he told the client that it should connect to 4 GPUs, all of which were pointing to the same GPU, but the program was acting as it had 4 GPUs. So even for testing, if you want to write something with multiple GPUs but you only have one, then you can use this to simulate it. Pretty hefty.
And that works, because there should be side effects in the runtime.
Yeah. No, it you have to explicitly tell, I want 4 GPUs, and the first GPU is host slot, and the second GPU is host 2 slot, whatever. And if you point all of the slots to the same, all of the GPU pointers, so to speak, to the same, then the RCUDA daemon on the other end will just interleave or intermix, multiplex all the requests. Yeah, it won't be like 4 times faster, obviously, but...
No, I'm just thinking about like when it can obfuscate a certain class of concurrency bugs, if that... But I don't know enough of CUDA programming to do anything here. But nice stuff.
Nice.
So there was a new talk basically on the HPC Advisory Council.
There was a new talk?
Like always.
Yeah. I mean, I talked also with new stuff. I mean, I had the state of the Linux container iteration, like an iteration of the talks I gave twice or three times even, which you can call thrice in English, I think. And I also talked about service orchestration. So I think then I would like to introduce a new paradigm that everyone is using the auxiliary service in data centers in containers. I think that would be very cool. So I try to push for this a little bit, and hopefully this will stick, that everyone is using monitoring and logs and all this in containers instead of installing it natively. I think that will help a lot. But let's see how this pans out. Yeah, but this was quite cool. I really like this. And this talk from Peter of the EuroExa project was also very interesting. And as said, I would like to talk to him on this very podcast a little bit with your help.
And cool. Where's he from?
From Peter. Sheffield.
Ah, the Brits.
The Brits.
Oh, nice. They are not. Are they not out of the EU?
Political podcast.
No, we're not. We're not going there. No. It's fine. No. Let's work together with them.
Yeah.
Hexascale. Oh, cool.
Hexascale. Yeah. Not hexascale.
Hexa or hexa.
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 Like exabyte.
Yeah. E X A. Oh, my typing is so bad.
Oh, now someone is pushing the ringer here in my mother's place, but they have to wait. It's podcast time.
No.
Okay, that's that. Another.
Oh, here it is. Mark, the Wikipedia knows about it.
Pardon?
The Wikipedia has it already.
Yeah, sure it is. It's a long project. I think they started 2 years ago or so.
Oh. And the Brits started on themselves, apparently. So we are lucky that they still work with us. Oh, God.
Come on, next topic. Like, don't get yourself caught in the middle here. Topic of the week.
We build diesel engines. Yeah. And we will do this for the next 100 years in Germany. Oh, it's so sad.
Topic of the week. Docker Swarm, Kubernetes, and developer challenges. What is this?
Yeah. Oh, I brought it up.
Brought it up.
Yeah, it's basically... since 2 years, I guess it's now 2 years, 2.5 years almost, we have worked adopting Docker in our environments for the developers. So basically, when I fire up my IDE, I will do, of course, my test-driven development. I'm very strict on that, and
sure
then
you do.
Everything is tested nicely, and then I see, well, I need to integrate with other systems because we're all doing microservices nowadays, and then we were basically trying to get within our IDE the support of running multiple Docker containers in a stack. And therefore, we could run two microservices that we know we have written, and then the backend systems that relate to that. Most of the time, that's Elasticsearch and Kafka for me. And I could basically write tests against the whole stack, and then would assert my results and be fine. I have just another command lining in test integration or Maven test integration profile or something, and I could execute that. And everybody who had Docker
Podcast
Swarm
auch, deswegen
had to were able to reproduce my tests and also basically
kann ich sprechen gerade.
How Curie was saying that is basically you get a more sophisticated feeling that what you have done actually works and not only your test is passing or it works on my machine. And what I'm trying to get at is that we were using Docker Swarm from the very startup because you basically just add a YAML file to your repository and you kind of state in the README, please install Docker. And even for bigger projects, you would say, please join with your colleague and make a Docker Swarm. Here's how you do it. And then you would share your two working working boxes, and you would then have a tiny cluster where you can run multiple servers.
Yeah.
And but we cannot forget that from the operations side, there's Docker Swarm is kind of seen as a follow-up on Docker itself, and and it's kind of like it. Yeah, I don't know why. I don't know why that is the attitude amongst several SREs I came across, but they don't see a very high maturity, I guess, in Docker Swarm. I mean, it's a young project, and Kubernetes is a little bit more mature. I've tested just briefly with Kubernetes. I can see that I can translate my compose files, and but in the end, it was all not that easy for me. And the Minikube solution, yeah, many things are analog, but I still tend to move towards Docker Swarm. I think the ease of development is still a little bit better here.
Yeah, I think I mean, just to push in a little bit, and we talked with Albert about this a little bit as well, right? I think that the big strength of Docker is that it's so easy to use, and that you have this Docker file, you create images with it, and you can easily integrate it with Docker Compose files, and you can run it on your Docker engine. And if you want to scale to more hosts, Docker Swarm is also, if you do your containers right, pretty easy to use. But for development, this is totally cool. And for some production environments, I think it's fair to say it's also pretty solid. But I can understand, and I emphasize somehow with the operations guys, I mean, I'm working now for Docker, so I want everyone to understand use Docker Swarm. But I can understand that people say Swarm is like 1 year old or 2 years old now. Or no, I think the Swarm kit is 1 year old only, and that they are not trusting that much, or that they are not that trusting with it because it's so early in the stages, in its infancy. And
I can also see that, and it's fine. My question is more or less, if we were to work cross-functional, and if we share our resources together, and maybe at one point there are more companies that try the you build it, you run it paradigm, where are we then? Should we, I mean, will there be a better intersection, or a spot where you go, okay, I don't need Kubernetes for the developers, but still everything you do is really comparable with what we do in Kubernetes in production? Or you think there will be, I think it's a little bit of a challenge to communicate. I don't think actually in terms of features it's that difference, or there shouldn't be actually any war or I know it better and you are losers and blah, blah, blah. Nothing like that. I think if I test a stack completely integrated, yeah, I should be fine whether or not it's running in Kubernetes or Docker Swarm. I tested every integrating system with my system, and therefore I have a lot of confidence that what I did is actually shippable.
Yeah.
And if it's shipped with Kubernetes, I don't mind, and Docker Swarm just helps me in the ease of use.
I think there's a lot of influences to this decision and a lot of things you have to take into account, one of which is bias, like self-confirmation bias, and the expectation that what others do is not good and that what I do is good. So if the developers come up with Docker Swarm and Docker first and then Docker Swarm, and they throw it over the fence and we have to use it, there is a reaction to this, right? And I think that's what I saw a lot of times, that people just say, yeah, okay, kids, you had Docker and you are fine with it. But the serious guys in the ops world, we want to have something that we can claim ourselves, and this is Kubernetes, and you have to deal with it. And if you suffer a little bit, that's exactly where we want you to be. Like, if you are fine with your workloads, work processes, then something is wrong. I mean, maybe that's a little bit over the edge. No. I'm a little bit sarcastic,
yeah,
but it's
over the edge. Yeah, but it's ownership and who brought it to attention and who is yeah, it's kind of like being the innovator or not, or running behind, or being the lead in something.
Yeah, and being the guy who knows it. Back,
yeah, it comes all back to love.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. If you felt not loved, you're not caring. You're taking risk. And this is organizational risk, right? If you build up your silos and you try to make, we're not saying that SREs always do these argument change, but it's just that they are around once organization is split into teams that are not taking care about the whole everything, but just aspects of software development. And I think these splits in organizations, yeah, produce then teams that have these weird broken communications with each other.
But not only
because
this.
In the end, yeah, sorry.
Not only this, I think that what plays into it as well is how everything is documented and how the communication between the team is. I mean, if the developers come up with Docker and then with Docker Swarm and everything is nicely documented, every workflow is documented, and SREs can like look into it from the very start, and they have visibility how it's done, and they can like learn and be more mature with the complete stack, then they won't mind, I guess. It's just that it builds up over time, and then someone says, okay, let's do what the dev guys do, and then the operations are, yeah, they are not aware, or they were not aware how it's working, so they try to come up with a countermeasure against this, and then they come up with Kubernetes. Maybe that's also a little bit sarcastic, but I think there is some merit to it.
Yeah, but yeah, I think it from the solutions and the capabilities, I think from software development perspective, you should basically get just a real good feeling about what you are trying to release. And that also includes, of course, documentation, step-by-step runbooks, recovery, where to look at when something goes wrong, what to measure, what is the metrics that an operator must be interested in managing your service. And if this is all done, it really doesn't matter, I guess, what is what in terms of technologies. But then you have been nice in giving it to any operator, and then maybe the operator likes you afterwards, and then you can make him even use Clojure to make his monitoring system work.
True. Yeah, I think
maybe not.
Yeah, I mean,
that's too far-fetched.
It depends on so many things, and we will see. I think it depends on what's your business objective. Do you want to have a very sophisticated or not stable and reliable service, or do you care more about iterations and software releases? If you have a backend service for Candy Crush, maybe you don't care if 1% of your users get dropped because
your backend service doesn't matter. Your user comes back every
because
every
he's eight
minute.
And he doesn't care. Yeah. But if you are a bank or you're a stockbroker and you lose $100 million because someone fucked something up, then
then it's getting expensive.
Yeah, so it's all about incentives, psychology, the human condition.
Oh God! Once we are all robots, it's fixed.
Yeah, I can't wait.
Maybe not.
Maybe not.
Should we wrap up?
Yeah, I think we. Yeah, we should like target an hour or so, right? So let's wrap up. Damn it. Sorry, my chapter marking is not working as I would like it to.
Yeah, I guess we just make more of these podcasts now, and we just get better over time, like a natural learning curve.
But what did we learn today? So
I'm still confused why we could... So what we were using is these Studio Link. And I can hear you can hear me, that's great, via Studio Link IP, but then we were also using Slack, and we could still call us, and everything worked. I don't know how this is possible, because for me, I thought my output would now stream with my audio device onto the IP socket from Studio Link, and then it's basically gone. I don't know how we share this But yeah, we learned nothing. I'm just totally confused about how we can actually make this working here.
But that's also a human condition. The more you learn, the more you know that you don't know shit. Yeah. So that's true as well.
Yeah. I'm amazed. So hopefully the quality is okay in the final rendering. And we'll see. So we get better over time.
And so in the news section, this was housekeeping, and we get fiber here in the next 2 years. Anyways, in the news section, we talked about KSQL, so queryable stream processors, which are coming, which are in alpha, but we are all excited about. And we also talked about Elasticsearch. So and the modus operandi here is that I talk about what you brought up and you talked about what I brought up, and then maybe we learn something about what we misunderstood. So Elasticsearch provides a new documentation. They open up the best practice section, kind of, and they have also two new APIs, Shrink and Rollover, which helps with, what is it, data strategy, data retention, data retirement. There's a cool term for it, but I forgot it.
They are basically all right. So we are caring about, in certain scenarios, about the retention. We also need to retire data, meaning old data doesn't need to be very quick in query response times, but still should be around.
I now know. Data lifecycle management.
This is what I was looking for. Yeah, that's good. I don't even know if Elasticsearch is using that new buzzy term. Christian.
It's pretty old.
Is it?
Yeah, it's like, totally old. Anyway, and then what was I talking about? Just to check if you were not sleeping while I was talking about my excitement.
The EU has a new initiative for exascale computing, and we will invite a guy who talks about this on a follow-up show. You were interviewing in Spain with some friends of yours from the HP Advisory Council, one from who is doing this native interfaces for the Hadoop ecosystem, and the other one, I forgot.
Dan Olds.
Sorry, Dan Olds, yeah.
We talked about the student cluster competition, and he's a very fun guy, so he would be totally appropriate to be with you as well. It was a lot of fun to talk to him because he's very funny.
Cool. And you will get fiber at some point in flyoverland of Germany. That's what I got.
Yeah. And we should somehow come up with a way that we can both collaborate on the show notes somehow, so that you can look at them as well. Because I'm cheating. I have them here, so I know what we are talked about. So it's a little unfair to you.
At least one knows. Is there another even worse term for flyoverland? Because I think where I grew up, there are actually no planes flying over. So there will
not
never
even
be any
flyoverland.
It's not even flyoverland, exactly.
Yeah, and then we talked about Arcuda, which is pretty cool, and I'm looking forward to do with it a little bit. And my idea of pushing service orchestration more so that everyone is using containers for the stuff they don't want to run anyways, but they have to in order to operate efficiently. Yeah, that was our news section. And then we have our topic of the week with the long-lasting fight between dev and ops about what orchestrator to use.
Yes. And would you mind officially saying what you are doing in your future life?
Yeah.
Or did you mention that already on the podcast?
Actually, yeah, today my first day of Docker is on me. So I'm starting at Docker now for the customer success team as a technical account manager for Europe or some region in Europe. See. I'm pretty excited. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Congratulations. Yeah, I think you didn't brought me to Docker, actually. That was a former colleague of mine, but you certainly made me use it for the last 1.5 years. And Yeah, it's sad that I'm now not sharing an office with you anymore. But on the other hand, we have this podcast and you are up for new adventures. That's good.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, really exciting. It's going to be... I think I have to either use some sedatives all day because I have to... I don't know. I have to calm myself down to not burst with new ideas and...
Don't worry, man. You will be still in Germany and there are a lot of IT departments in Germany that aren't quite exciting, I would say. So,
yeah.
You will come across a web sphere ecosystem and a JBoss web sphere bundled legacy system that kind of worked since 5 years now and all this stuff. I mean, you can give them hope, but... there will be legacy.
Yeah,
in your
sure.
Life.
Yeah, no. I mean, and that's all the traditional operation of data center. As you said, there are a lot of people who can how to put it carefully, like use containers to improve. But as I'm a little bit beefed because I got to this HPC Advisory Council workshop and I'm eager to push Docker there as well because there's so much that could be done.
I have this Python script here which reaches out to 100 million servers of mine and then they will be all provisioned and I have handwritten it and it's not tested, but it works.
yeah. This and
deployments.
Other things. Let's see.
Yeah,
but I'm beefed. I can't wait to get my feet wet. And in 2 weeks, there's DockerCon in Copenhagen. So if someone of our three listeners is around, then shoot me an email and we can talk. Or have a beer.
Yeah.
Or talk
have a remote
and have
podcast.
A beer. Or have a podcast. Yeah, I totally bring my gear and I will... have a look if I can get some of the Docker colleagues to talk. Let's see. Maybe
cool.
With some beer. Yeah. That's cool. Yeah. It's going to be fun. I'm looking forward.
Nice. Okay, cool. Then
cool.
We wrap it up.
Yep.
And
maybe
talk to you soon.
What? Let's. Can we commit to a schedule? Can we say we do it every end of the weekish?
We should basically, I think.
Yeah,
that
we
should be possible, but it should be. There will be late nights though, because Sundays is Badetag.
Yeah, no,
so
maybe
sometimes they will be very late, but then they come out early on Monday, whatever.
Yeah, maybe I thought maybe Friday or Saturday or Thursday.
Oh, Friday is also good. Yeah, Friday after work, and then just for coming down and get the latest and release the pain from the work week. That's also a good idea.
Yeah,
let's
then
try
the
something.
Listeners can listen over the weekend to
yeah,
get over the weekend until they get to work on Monday, so they can.
Then let's not be that concrete. Let's say over the weekend there might be a production of a new podcast.
Yeah, and I think
somewhere.
I'm pretty happy with our already very happy with the setup. So all the chapter marks is pretty cool to do, and it should be very fast. So. We record it, and then hopefully within an hour or so, it should be up. And so if we do it on Saturday, then our listeners have something to listen to on Sunday. Maybe this is our goal, that it's available on Sunday somehow. Let's see. Let's see.
Let's see where we are.
I mean, we commit to it, and then in 2 weeks, we stop. No, we don't. We will. We will pursue.
Let's not raise the bar too high.
No. All right.
Have a nice weekend or rest weekend and talk to you.
Yeah, talk to you next week then.
Yo.
Bye-bye.
Bye.